In 1811, Benjamin Rush wrote to John Adams, urging him to repair his broken friendship with Thomas Jefferson.
"And now, my dear friend, permit me again to suggest to you to receive the olive branch which has thus been offered to you by the hand of a man who still loves you. Embrace each other. Bedew your letters of reconciliation with tears of affection and joy. Bury in silence all the causes of your separation. Recollect that explanations may be proper between lovers, but are never so between divided friends. Were I near to you, I would put a pen into your hand and guide it while it composed the following short address to Mr. Jefferson. Quote, friend and fellow laborer, in the cause of the liberty and independence of our common country, I salute you with the most cordial wishes for your health and happiness. John Adams, unquote.
I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, immersed in the letters of the Founding Fathers. More than 30 people who spent the last 3 years working on thousands of letters written by the Founding Fathers are experiencing a sense of loss and sorrow now that the massive project to make them available online has come to a close. Bill Kissel, Donna Carty, and Dina Radley are my first guests. They were part of a team from Documents Compass that proofread and digitized more than 50,000 letters of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John and Abigail Adams, and James Madison as one part of a larger national archives project called Founders Online. Bill, Donna, and Dina, you spent months and even years now together reading and transcribing the letters of the Founding Fathers. You've said you've been deeply moved and maybe even changed by it. Bill, is that fair?
Oh, it's very fair. Somewhere in that process, I remember having seen a production of Hamlet, when at the very end, the whole stage was full of blood-covered bodies. And then as the lights came down, all the bodies stood up and came to the foreground. And it was as if those people had suddenly, in fact, come alive. And that's exactly how I felt about these letters. I felt as if each one of them individually or collectively should stand up and come forward for what was a curtain call and well-deserved applause. They were just terribly real and personal to me.
And Dina, you said they felt maybe less like characters on stage than intimates of yours.
This was like a soap opera. I got so involved in the reading, and I was one of the few people that was specialized in Abigail Adams' letters. Her writing, handwriting is a little difficult. I could guess a letter. I could guess what that word was because I became so intimately involved with her writing that I could almost anticipate what she was going to say.
What sort of writer was she? Was she emotional? Was she brilliant?
She was emotional. That's why I got totally involved in this, because she expressed herself so visually. I mean, if she was angry about something, if she was disappointed in someone, she just said it. Most of what she wrote about were her children and what was going on, her grandchildren. Detailed progress reports, but very involved in all of her children and grandchildren's lives.
Did you find yourself wanting to come to work just to see what would happen today?
Oh, the next chapter, absolutely. Always, always looking forward to this job. I've told everyone in my life that I found my calling. Unfortunately, it had a beginning and an end. But yes, love this job.
Donna, the job is what? There were more than 20 of you who were transcribing accurately in teams these letters of the Founding Fathers?
Yes, we were in teams of two. There were about 40 of us all together. One person had the actual letter in front of them, an image of it, in the original handwriting. And the other person had a transcript that was made some time ago when they didn't have the tools that we have now to be accurate. The one I remember in particular the best is the town in New Hampshire that wrote to Jefferson that they would be delighted to go to war with France. But the transcriber had them writing, "We will arise from our vices and go and gather camels on the dry fields of Mars." Now, something had to be wrong with that.
And what was it?
Well, what they were saying is, "We will arise from under our vines, our grapevines, and we will go and gather laurels on the dry fields of Mars," because Mars was the god of war. So we were always coming on things like that, that we had to check the spellings, check the name, because sometimes people would spell them differently.
I think one of the things these letters did is began to show us the multiple sides of these people. And Abigail certainly had the Mama Bear side, but she also was not at all hesitant to be a very engaging politician. And she was also, as John was, somewhat of a classicist in that she would quote poetry at the drop of a hat.
Who were some of the poets she might refer to?
Well, she would certainly refer to Shelley. She would refer to Milton. I suppose John would refer to Swift. They quoted very often in Latin or even in Greek.
So they did often write with phrases in Latin and Greek?
Indeed, they did. I have a feeling that Abigail pulled it out of her memory, whereas I feel that John and Jefferson probably turned to their library to find the appropriate quote.
Bill, you've said also that there were many instructions to sons and friends and daughters about certain classical books that should be read for a fully rounded education.
Well, he certainly would refer to the Greek works, whether they be Homer, whether they be Euripides, whether they be Sophocles or whatever. There were a number of references to Shakespeare. John Adams, again, isn't it funny? I call him John. Certainly quoted Shakespeare and referred to Shakespeare as an essential part of one's education. There was an inference in all that, that if you don't understand or be able to quote those things, you simply aren't educated.
And Dina, would you find yourself running to look up a book and maybe try to read about it yourself?
Yes. A certain book would be quoted, and I would get on Jefferson Madison Regional Library website and reserve the book and then check it out or listen to something on tape.
Did you bring the background of an historian to this project yourself?
Yes. I majored in political science and history, and I thought I knew what was going on. But I found that I did not know most of what I've learned. I knew Abigail Adams was John Adams' wife, and I knew that she was very popular, but I was not aware of Abigail Adams' intricate contribution to John and the whole presidency. Theirs was a real partnership, much like Hillary and Bill Clinton's.
Did you have an appreciation for history through all this of more than just fleshing out the individuals? Did it help you see the global context better?
Yes. I was not aware of the events going on in Europe and their influence on the American scene. For instance, John Adams took it upon himself. While he was sitting around in Europe, he got so bored, he took it upon himself to go to the Dutch bankers and got money for us. He single-handedly did that, and he had no permission from the Congress.
You mean to finance the revolution?
Yes. I had no idea. This was like behind-the-scenes things that are not in history books that I've come across.
You got very much the impression of just how tentative a country we were and what the opinion was of the European countries. I mean, they half expected us to disappear.
How could you tell?
The lack of respect. The American flag mattered nothing whatsoever. They had no hesitation whatsoever, the British, of basically just taking over an American ship, declaring all the American seamen British if they had originally come from Britain, and conscripting them onto their ships.
Bill, I asked each of you to bring some of the excerpts of the letters that really struck you in the course of this project to show the depth and breadth of these people. Tell us what struck you.
Mm-hmm. This is a letter written in 1815, and this kind of illustrates what I call the everyman side of John Adams. He wrote, "I wish I could take a walk with you in all the churchyards and burying grounds in Virginia. How many hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children have lived and died in Virginia to whom no monument has been created? Open your soul, sir, and disclose your natural feelings and frankly say whether you would change ancestors with any man living. I believe you would not. Is there a human being who would? How shall any legislator prevent the rich, the great, the powerful, the learned, the ingenious from distinguishing by durable, costly, and permanent memorials their own ancestors from the descendants of the vast, the immense majority who lie mingled with the dust totally forgotten?" And that struck me. There was a note of pathos in that, a sadness that I think I can only call John Adams' sense of every man. This is a letter that he wrote to his great friend Dr. Rush in 1806, so again he was out of office. "We in this commonwealth are making great advances, if not in the perfectibility of human nature, yet in the great art of lying and libeling and the other arts which grow out of them, such as wielding the cudgel and the pistol. There is little for me to lose in the worst times or cases that can happen. My property is small, and the remainder of my life is short. But, oh, my country, how I mourn over thy follies and vices, thy ignorance and imbecility, thy contempt of wisdom and virtue, and overweening admiration of fools and knaves." John Adams and patriotism, a strong streak in him that runs through almost all his letters.
Don't you so admire him for that?
I admired him enormously for that, and I felt a keen sense of where is that today.
And so did the common people. They thought these people could do anything.
How do you know that?
Well, I remember specifically one letter to Thomas Jefferson from the western edge of Kentucky. And he said, "My neighbor's son has been kidnapped by Indians, and now they claim to own him. What are you going to do about it?"
Ha! Huh. They thought they walked on water.
Absolutely.
There's another wonderful one. I remember Donna and I read this together, and we got almost into a giggling fit over it. It was so funny. This is about Franklin, and it's a letter written by John Adams to a woman whose name I've forgotten. But one excerpt from that is this little touch on Franklin. "The Duchess de Polignac was a great admirer of the Grand Franklin. When in company with the king and queen, she was always launching out in panegyrics upon the Grand Franklin. The king sometimes smiled, sometimes snickered, but said very little. After some time upon a visit to the royal manufactory of porcelain at Sèvres, he gave secret orders to have a chamber pot made of the finest materials and most exquisite workmanship, with the most exact portrait of the Grand Franklin painted on the bottom of it, on the inside. The king presented this to the Duchess with his own hand, that she might have the satisfaction of contemplating the image of her grand philosopher and politician whenever she had the occasion to look at it." You can imagine, Donna and I read that, and we just said, is that what he's really saying? We just laughed and giggled.
And what are they talking about, the Grand Franklin? We think of him as the everyman, a very simple, bright guy. Why would they have mocked him so?
He was kind of poking fun at him, that is, Adams was. He was kind of poking at the success socially that Franklin apparently had in France that he, John Adams, did not have. And I think there was a touch of envy in that.
The French got Franklin. They considered him like themselves. They understood him. Adams, not so much.
Adams was very religious and very faithful to his wife Abigail, where Franklin left his wife Deborah and their, I believe, 12 children, took his place as the Postmaster General of the United States. She did all the work while he was in France. And he slept with I don't know how many women over there and just got into the whole raunchiness of the French society, where Adams stuck his nose up at that.
But Jefferson also sort of embraced this freer, libertine French culture.
Yes, both Jefferson and Franklin did. But Adams seemed to be more in tune with the British at that point. There was a fantastic relationship between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson when they both served in Europe. And in fact, Thomas Jefferson spent most of his waking hours at Abigail and John's mansion. And after they both came back to this country, they were on totally opposite sides of many, many issues. There were hurt feelings back and forth, and at one point, Benjamin Rush, who is considered the father of psychology and had served in the Continental Congress with John Adams, and they had become very close, but he also kept in touch with Thomas Jefferson, and he formed a bridge between them. I'm going to start crying now. And if I can read from that letter. This is a letter he wrote to John Adams in December of 1811. "And now, my dear friend, permit me again to suggest to you to receive the olive branch which has thus been offered to you by the hand of a man who still loves you. fellow laborers in erecting the great fabric of American independence, fellow sufferers in the calumnies and falsehoods of party rage, fellow heirs of the gratitude and affection of posterity, and fellow passengers in a stage that must shortly convey you both into the presence of a judge with whom the forgiveness and love of enemies is the condition of acceptance. Embrace each other. Bedew your letters of reconciliation with tears of affection and joy. Bury in silence all the causes of your separation. Recollect that explanations may be proper between lovers, but are never so between divided friends. Were I near to you, I would put a pen into your hand and guide it while it composed the following short address to Mr. Jefferson. Quote, friend and fellow laborer, in the cause of the liberty and independence of our common country, I salute you with the most cordial wishes for your health and happiness. John Adams, unquote. And he wrote to Jefferson. And as the letters progressed, there were 150-some letters over the until they passed away. The irony, you know, and they say this couldn't have been written on the Jubilee year, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams passed away. And it was almost as though they both lived for that day. Jefferson passed away about 5 hours before John Adams. And John Adams, of course, did not know that. And his final words were something to the effect of, Thomas Jefferson survives.
Oh, gosh.
Don't you get goosebumps thinking about that? At the time, John Adams was 91 and Thomas Jefferson was 83.
You were also saying earlier that you had just come to be so touched and immersed in the life of Abigail Adams. Did you mourn her passing yourself?
Absolutely. As well as when her daughter passed away. Her daughter, Abigail Jr., they called her Nabby, died of breast cancer. I think I was surprised that they even knew what cancer was then. Abigail was so upset she couldn't even go and tend to Abby, who had taken a lengthy coach trip from where she lived in New York to her parents' home to die there. It was John Adams who took care of Nabby in the final week or two of her life. And I would never have thought that John would have the... You see him as a very formal, kind of stiff person, but he was the one who tended to his daughter.
Do you feel as though you're experiencing a loss now? Are you having withdrawal from this terrific play, this incredible miniseries that you want more episodes and seasons of?
We're all shaking our heads, yes. That's the word, withdrawal. I got teary-eyed just talking about this today because I do miss it. It's like it was such a part of my life.
I've been known to say that we would get out our shovels and dig them up if we could get them to write more letters.
Yeah, I think all of that's true, but I think somewhere in this we're missing something. It's one thing to say we wish the letters were, as they're going to be, readily available, and it's one thing to say we wish they could be read or read by kids or adults fascinated with the period. But it's an altogether different thing to find the enchantment in them that... that we found by the immersion.
Bill and Dina and Donna, thank you for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
You're very welcome, and I think we thank you for giving us the chance to share them with more people.
Bill Kissel, Donna Carty, and Dina Radley all worked on Documents Compass, which contributed to the larger Founders Online project of the National Archives. Thanks to the National Archives, there are now more than 150,000 fully searchable letters of the Founding Fathers available for free online. Here to talk about Founders Online are Kathleen Williams and Sue Perdue. Kathleen Williams is Executive Director of the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives, and Sue Perdue is Program Director of Documents Compass at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Kathleen, we've all heard of the National Archives, but few of us have occasion to visit. What do you think most of us would have occasion to recognize that's part of the National Archives?
Well, I think that would naturally fall to what we call the Charters of Freedom, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, and the Bill of Rights. But it also includes all of the presidential libraries that have been established. Plus, it will include papers of individual presidents before they were presidents.
Are people aware that Founders Online exists?
Increasingly. That's a really good question. Yeah. We want as many people as possible to know that it's online. Right now, we're in cahoots with an entity from North Carolina called the National Humanities Center, which is doing two things. It's developing teacher webinars, specifically using Founders Online as its resource, and it's developing interactive lessons for teachers to use with their students in the classroom, again, using Founders Online. The reason I'm so excited about this is because that really gets at what I think teaching history is all about. It's not just a bunch of facts and figures. It's about looking at the documents from the past and bringing review and analysis to those documents to develop a deeper understanding of what were the choices, what were the decisions, who were the players, and what was the outcome.
Sue, let me ask you, when you first were charged by Kathleen with digitizing these letters, editing them, getting them online, you had to hire a small army smart people.
We did. We did have to hire a small army, numbering about 35 to 50 people at its highest point, probably 50 people. It introduced a lot of people who had no experience with working with documents to a world that I think changed them.
Was it full-time work or part-time?
Part-time work. And so many were temporary workers who came into this having retired from the workforce or having done something else entirely different. We had one woman who'd studied physics, school bus driver. You know, it really ran the gamut. Oh, a rock star, a guy who has a rock band. But they all kind of united over this excitement over reading John and Abigail Adams or you name it. It was just energizing for them.
Could you see that growth over time?
Completely. It was like they all sort of adopted particular people. They got really enamored of the people that they were reading, and they became really devoted to the process.
So when you began the Documents Compass portion of this Founders Online effort, you realized, oh my gosh, I've got to take these 35 to 50 people and create a little knowledge factory. And to do that, you did something I've heard very unusual. You showed them a scene from I Love Lucy.
Right. It's funny you should say factory because it's just that scene from I Love Lucy where she and Ethel are making chocolates in the chocolate factory and the factory manager yells, "Speed it up." And suddenly they're moving faster than they can handle them. And I showed that to all of my staff, which was really great because, number one, they all found it really funny. And many of them knew that show because they had grown up with it. But it was really to demonstrate the idea that, yes, we were going to try to keep some sort of balance between the quality production at the same time while maintaining a steady speed.
And how many documents did you have from which of the founding fathers?
So we had a total of about 51,000 documents.
How long does it take to do one letter?
We averaged, I think our original prediction was about an hour per letter, and that was all of the steps that needed to take place. But that average doesn't hold up necessarily because sometimes we had letters that were 70 pages long, in which case then actually it would take about 10 hours to proofread it.
And the other problem, of course, is these people had unreadable handwriting.
Exactly. Or you have documents with holes in them, or the copy that we have to read from is a little fuzzy. So there are a lot of hurdles to get over in order to get a good transcription of a document.
And Kathleen, have you heard from people who've read any of the letters online?
We have evidence from users of the site writing to us with some frequency, expressing their thanks and their appreciation, just as users. If I could just quickly pick from one or two, I've got a high school teacher writing to me, quote, "This resource is breathtaking in its scope and value. I already have students accessing it for their class projects."
Well, we've heard from people as far away as California, who one woman in particular, who said that if she hadn't had something like Founders Online, she would have had to pay to travel to Washington, D.C., or wherever she could get access to all this material, that it's really, for, in her words, a gold mine for her research. Likewise, we've heard of a gentleman who is a composer who works at the Berklee School of Music, who lives in Boston, who's writing a cantata based on George Washington's letters from the Revolutionary War period. So there are really surprising ways that people would use these letters.
Well, Kathleen and Sue, this has been fabulous and fascinating. Thank you for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sue Perdue is the Program Director of Documents Compass at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Kathleen Williams is Executive Director of the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives. You're listening to a cantata with lyrics taken from a letter George Washington wrote when he returned home after the Revolutionary War. The piece was composed in all parts sung by Gates Thomas, a professor at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. Gates says he'd been reading the great biography of George Washington by James Thomas Flexner when he was struck by a quote from Washington's own writing. Returning home to Mount Vernon after 9 years away, Washington spied a grove of trees that he had planted just before leaving for war, and he wrote his impression of the site in a letter to one of his French generals. "Those trees which my hands have planted, by their rapid growth, at once indicate a knowledge of my declination and their disposition to spread their mantles over me before I go hence to return no more. For this, their gratitude, I will nurture them while I stay."
By their rapid growth,
is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Elliot Majerzik and Allison Quantz are our associate producers. Our assistant producer is Lilia Fukin. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. And Jeannie Palin handles listener services. Miranda Bennett is our intern. Visit us at withgoodreasonradio.org or download the podcast on iTunes. To reach us, call 877-451-5098. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.